seminar in Montesquieu, session 26, April 25th, 1966.
That was you raised the question which one must raise. After all, everyone who is not especially interested in French institutions, especially in feudalism, what is the meaning of this book within the context of the spirit of laws? And you answered this question correctly, that the point is that if we take the example of Du Bois in particular, belongs to the enlightened despotism, which Montesquieu opposes. And Montesquieu would prefer the qualified, the limited monarchy to the absolute monarchy. And this is perfectly compatible, of course, with his preferring even the British constitution, even to that limited monarchy. That is surely the case. You did not speak about the methodic question which we have to raise. The fact is that these are historical investigations. But one could say one's a question of the genesis of the French monarchy is raised, which is in itself a historical question. One must better be a good historian like Montesquieu rather than a bad historian like Du Bois. You did not mention the other alternative in the view of feudalism which Montesquieu attacks.
Oh, the Boulanger's?
Yes.
Well, that seemed, I think, to him to be too radical in the sense that he seemed to divorce himself from any moderation in respect to the king. He seemed to place, the nobles, the noble.
What was his view, the chief point of Boulanger's view?
It seemed to be, well, just the opposite, actually, of Du Bois's. Montesquieu seemed to be somewhere in between the two.
Yes, he says so.
Yeah.
But what is Boulanger's, what is the salient point of Boulanger's view?
Well, that the nobles, the rights of the nobles, he somehow derives it from the Romans, too, I think.
The key point is that according to Du Bois, the French, the Franks, were called in by the Romans, and therefore the French king was a successor to the Roman emperor, i.e. an absolute ruler. Boulanger says no, the Franks came in as conquerors, and the French nobility are the descendants from the conquerors, whereas the Third Estate are the descendants from the natives, the Gauls, the Roman Gauls, Romano-Gauls. And therefore, the right of conquest is absolutely in favor of the rule of France by the French nobility. And of course, this is also, apart from the fact that it is not simply correct, both conquest, but not in this form, with the legal consequences which Boulanger assumed. But Montesquieu is, of course, also opposed to the notion of an unqualified rule of the nobility, and also the whole notion of the right of conquest underlining is not, as we have seen, according to his taste. Now, let us thank you very much again, and let us now turn to some of the most important passages. At the beginning, in chapter 1, Montesquieu makes clear the importance of the subject, feudalism. Perhaps you read the first sentence, Mr. Rankin.
I should think my work imperfect were I to pass over in silence an event which never again, perhaps, will happen.
An event which happened once in the world and may not happen ever again. Let us stop here. So Montesquieu asserts hitherto feudalism was unique. Of course, not in France, but in the whole Western Europe, including Central Europe. But he says it may happen again, which will perhaps never happen again, which may happen again. So his the view that certain things will never happen again. You remember we found some interesting passages. It's not accepted by Montesquieu unqualifiedly. He regards the futurism as possible in the future already. Now, the view which prevails today, as far as I remember, is that feudalism is not a phenomenon limited to Middle Ages, European Middle Ages, but people speak also of Japanese feudalism, for example. Now, with what right? I do not know. Do you know?
Well, they say that better than any other country, it is in people speak, but inaccurately, of feudal ages in China. They say
I beg your pardon?
People speak, but inaccurately, of feudal ages in China or India. In Japan, the closest approximation to Western feudalism, that is, a system of grants given to vassals for services on the condition of military service.
And inheritable?
Yes.
I see that. But
I think that may be a departure.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
It's a long time that I... Yes. Good. We keep this point in mind that Montesquieu does not exclude a return of that, not entirely. Now, let us turn to chapter 2 and read the first sentence there.
The conquerors of the Roman Empire came from Germany. Though few ancient authors have described their manners, yet we have two of very great weight. Caesar, making war against the Germans, describes the manners of that nation, and upon these he regulated some of his enterprises. A few pages of Caesar upon this subject are equal to whole volumes.
Well, you see the difference between the translator and Montesquieu. A few pages of Caesar on this matter are volumes. And then, of course, the same is true of Tacitus. Now, that is, of course, a very good beginning in this. I mean, a sound beginning. And the only question is only whether, by the time of the conquest of Gaul, the Germans had not undergone considerable changes, had not already become affected by Roman things. And today, I believe, scholars are more inclined to admit the Roman ingredient in feudalism than Montesquieu was. Is this not?
Yes, Gordon Child's book about Rome beyond the imperial wall, because not only had the Germans been coming in, but they'd been getting creature comforts from Rome for some 400 years.
So that was then the defect of Montesquieu, that he has not considered the starting point is sound, but between Tacitus and, the migration period, great changes had already occurred, yes. Now, the conclusion which Montesquieu draws from Tacitus and Caesar is stated in the last part of chapter 3.
Thus, among the Germans, there were vassals, but no fiefs. They had no fiefs, because the princes had no lands to give. Or rather, their fiefs consisted in horses trained for war, in arms and feasting. There were vassals because there were trusty men who, being bound by their word, engaged to follow the prince to the field, and did very nearly the same service as was afterwards performed for the fiefs.
Yes, another question arises then. What happened when France was conquered? And the key point which Montesquieu makes in chapter 5, as was pointed out by Mr. Eiching, that feudalism, whatever you may say against it, was surely not despotic government. That is indeed crucial to this point. Now let us turn, we don't have to read all these details. Montesquieu simply was compelled, after the question was raised as to the origin of the feudal laws, to go into all these details which to us are not immediately interesting, especially since in the meantime quite a few of his points have become antiquated. Yes, and then he discusses Bonavigie. In the last paragraph of chapter 9, he states what he thinks in his epigrammatic way, what he thinks of the two men.
Last you mean of the 10?
of chapter 10.
10, 178. The Comte de Boulainvilliers and the Abbé Dubos have formed two different systems, one of which seems to be a conspiracy against the commons, and the other against the nobility.
Namely, Boulainvilliers against the commons, and Dubos against the nobility. And then he quotes from Ovid. Yes. So he takes an intermediate position between these two authors, and this is a position not only as far as a historical question is concerned. Yes. Let us see in, well, we do not have to read everything else, but in chapter 11 he explains the gradual emergence of universal serfdom, you know, contrary to the situation as it was at the beginning. And in this connection he speaks especially of, among other things, of the serfs of the church in chapter 11. Yeah, well, we read perhaps, let me see, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, the 10th paragraph. I could cite authorities without
number. Oh, page 180, bottom. Here might I quote numberless authorities, and as the public compassion was raised at the sight of those miseries, as several...
Public compassion, as les entrailles de la charité. The bowels
of compassion moved at the sight of those moving, as several holy prelates, bishops, holy bishops, beholding the captives in chains, employed the treasure belonging to the church, and sold even the sacred utensils to ransom as many as they could. And as several holy monks exerted themselves on that occasion, it is in the lives of the saints that we meet with the best explanations on the subject. And, although it may be objected to the authors of those lives that they have been sometimes a little too credulous in respect to things which God has certainly performed, if they were in the order of his providence, yet we draw considerable light thence with regards to the manners and usages of those times.
You see, we know already this style of criticism. Yeah? I mean, he doesn't deny that these miracles have happened, but he says he only questions, he indicates a point from which one might question. If they made sense, he would have performed them, otherwise not. But surely there are very important, this ecclesiastical, this hagiographic literature is a very important source. Now go on.
When we cast an eye upon the monuments of our history and laws, the whole seems to be an immense expanse, a boundless ocean. All those frigid, dry, insipid, and hard writings must be read and devoured in the same manner as Saturn is fabled to have devoured the stones.
Meaning, so indigestible was to him this kind of literature. Let us read the last paragraph of this chapter.
It was a customary thing with the proprietors of lands to give them to the churches in order to hold them themselves by a quit rent, thinking to partake by their servitude of the sanctity of the churches.
So in other words, this is a genesis of the property and power of the church in France connected to the troubles of these early centuries. Yes. We turn to chapter 14. Yeah, let us read the third paragraph.
After the barbarians had quitted their own country, they were desirous of reducing their usages into writing. But as they found difficulty in writing German words with Roman letters, they published these laws in Latin. In the confusion and rapidity of the conquest, most things changed their nature. In order, however, to express them, they were obliged to make use of such old Latin words as were most analogous to the new usages. Thus, whatever was likely to revive the idea of the ancient census of the Romans, they called by the name of census tributum. And when things had no relation at all to the Roman census, they expressed, as well as they could, the German words by Roman letters. Thus they formed the word fredum, on which I shall have occasion to descant in the
which,
following.
I mean, this is a Germanic word, like Friede in present age. Yeah. You know, this is a good example of what is called historical thinking, such reflections which are intrinsically sound. I mean, whether they are, whether he's right in this particular point or not. I mean, that is a way in which one has to go about these kind of questions. Let us see the last paragraph of this chapter.
To apply the idea of the present time to distant ages is the most fruitful source of error. To those people who want to modernize all the ancient ages, I shall say what the Egyptian priest said to Solon. O Athenians, you are mere children.
Yes. Do you know where that occurs? In the Timaeus, in Plato's Timaeus. At the beginning. Near the beginning. Yes, now this is, of course, again a point of fundamental importance. If we want to understand other ages, we have to understand them according to the notions prevailing then, and not simply modernize them. This is a great, that is what was primarily meant by the historical sense, to, as Ranke, the great German historian, put it, to see how it truly has been. And that means, among other things, and perhaps above all, how it was viewed by the contemporaries and not by us today. Now, this has become, in one sense, generally accepted, but in fact, of course, it is still a great difficulty, because if you only think of the way in which the sociologists now approach different cultures, the concepts which they apply stem primarily from our life, from Western modern life, and therefore are a kind of Procrustean bed on which you bind, on which you put these alien institutions. Is there any example which would readily occur to us?
Say to describe something as a culture, where
this is already something, yeah, sure, very prejudicial, but more, perhaps something more concrete and therefore more convincing.
When they go talking about the political and religious systems of a reasonably simple island, where Papa is sort of the most respected man and people do what he says, and he may make reference to the gods, but Papa and none of the islanders the distinction between political, religious, and artistic systems.
Yes. Now, the whole distinction, for example, say between handicraft and art, to take another case, which is maybe wholly undistinguishable, and in no way known as a distinction to the people of that time, and therefore, how can you draw arbitrarily a line between their art history on the one hand and their crafts and technology on the other? So that Montesquieu was aware of the principle involved, and this, may I say, is in no way a novelty, an innovation of Montesquieu in itself, only he is, since he came at the beginning of this large movement, where it became a universal movement, he is so famous for that. Now, here we can perhaps, what is the precise point, though, to consider? Perhaps I bring this up first. These two books of the Spirit of Laws, more than any other part, mark the beginning of what we can call with Burke historical jurisprudence. I mean, of course, we must not never forget Vico, but Vico, that is a very special case. That was a very, Vico was a Napolitan with a very rugged individualist, and his influence beyond southern Italy is not clearly traced. I mean, Monsieur knew of him. Everyone knows something about in a trip to Naples. I don't know whether he met Vico, but he should have met some of the circle around Vico. Now, this, what Montesquieu started most visibly, led then to the flowering of historical studies in the 19th and 20th century, which surpasses everything that ever exists in the past, at least in extent. I mean, I think religious history, economic history, history of arts, history of science, history of languages, there's nothing which is not historically treated more or less ably since this time. This was a great enlargement of the horizon, and the self-admiration which many people in the 19th century had on this score is only surpassed by the self-admiration due to the development of modern science. What was the price paid for this flowering of the historical sciences? I think one can say that the decay of alleged or true knowledge of the ought, that is the price, of the norms or standards. And in retrospect, we see this particularly clearly, but it began already earlier. And how could this be, I mean, how could people be so blind to the fact that the knowledge of the standards is much more important than historical knowledge as such? Well, they thought in a manner that the understanding of history will make superfluous knowledge of the ought. Now, this seems fantastic, but this has happened very often. The most important case is that of Marx. Marx was a very great historian, there is no doubt about that. When you read, for example, his chapter on the primitive accumulation of capital, he breaks new ground. I mean, in the meantime, there is so much has been written beyond that, but Marx was in this way as original as Monsieur was in his. But when he speaks about this primitive accumulation of capital in the 15th, 16th century, he stresses all the time the crimes committed in that age, the injustices committed, you know, by the enclosers and all this kind of thing. So Marx has obviously a standard of justice which he doesn't take the trouble to elaborate. About everyone who would say, confronted with these facts, and if he had no axe to grind. But Marx's true argument is a bit more complicated. These were crimes, there's no doubt about that. But these crimes were necessary. Otherwise, capitalist society would never have come into being. And capitalist society is necessary so that the just order, the classless universal society, will come into being. And there is no need of an ought even here regarding the transition from capitalist to communist society, because the harsh interest of the large majority of men without any consideration of justice is perfectly sufficient for bringing about that change. Now, there is, of course, an ambiguity in Marx, because this, if people did not believe in their rights, they would not fight for it the way they do. But I took the example of Marx, only it is not the only one. But something of this kind has been happening throughout the 19th century, that people thought that the deeper historical understanding will make superfluous the striving for knowledge of the norms. Another simple form, of course, is this: there are no norms higher than the norms of your culture. Now, in order to know what these norms are, you have to analyze your culture in order to see what the norms are, because the norms would not only be those talked about, but also those inherent in the life and in the institution of the culture. Mr. Rankin?
To put the question, a more naive question. I have a feeling that Abbe Dubos and Comte de Boulainvilliers are already committing this when the question is one of how much power shall Louis XIV and his promoted bourgeois ministers have. Isn't it really rather absurd to go back to the origins of the Dark Ages to settle the question?
It's good you raise this question.
And have not these rather lesser men already evinced an appeal to history which should be very weak?
Yes. Now, this is, since I do not know, I knew once it was so-called aesthetic writing, but I never read his historical, and nor do I know that by Boulainvilliers. But I would suggest this point. The fact which you adduce, and without going into the details of these two authors, prove only this reasoning, which has nothing to do with the modern historical consciousness and in fact is incompatible with it. And that is that the old is the best. The origins are higher than anything stemming from the origins. And this is an old, that is as old as the records of mankind leaders, that people regard the old as more respectable. And that changed, of course, greatly. I mean, not only with the emergence of philosophy, when this was explicitly questioned, never forget the key passage, the authority statement, as it were, in Aristotle's Politics Book 2, men seek not the ancestor, but the good, meaning that is what men are truly after. And they only believe that erroneously that the ancestral is a good. Yeah. This is belongs, and you can say that is coeval with reason, the non-identification of the good with the ancestral. But what was a preserve of a small group of men, of the philosophers in the past, became widespread since the 17th century, and therefore, and culminated then in this notion of progress which developed, you know, first progress expected and hoped for, and then progress proven, and finally the certainty of progress for all future. It's these things which developed in the 17th and 18th century. This made eventually the older notion, the assumption that the good is the ancestor, wholly unintelligible. Speak to a teenager today, he would be wholly unless he comes from a backward stratum of society, he would not understand that.
But in some measure, the historical thing, the first stage is, you know, the old, the ancestral is the good, and then the second stage is the 17th, 18th Enlightenment, where not a few men believe in progress.
You could say that the new is the good. I mean, the other irrationality, the new is the good.
Perhaps that was why the problem came. But in some sense, the historical consciousness does seem to recapitulate the ancestral is the good or the norm.
Yeah, but in a much more subtle way. I would say it can easily decay into that, into the simple equation. But that is not the primary meaning of it. But it is a complicated thing because historical consciousness was in its earlier forms connected with the belief in progress, for example, in Herder, that there is on the whole an upward march and you have only to see each step in its context in order not to do violence to the individuality of each culture, things which are alive up to the present day. So let us then turn to chapter 15. The heading, we do not have to go into the details, because we will forget him as soon. In chapter 16, he explains the original form of the thief. The key change was that they originally were could be recalled at will by the king, and later on they became hereditary property, and this was then their final form. Occasionally he observes in chapter 17, and at the end of the fourth paragraph, a similar policy is even today observable in England, which is an allusion to this famous chapter. Now, that becomes still more clear, I think, in chapter 18, fifth and sixth paragraph.
Listen, yes.
One will perhaps believe that the government of the Franks was at that time very harsh. Do you have it? On page 100.
It will be 185, second paragraph. It will be imagined, perhaps, that the government of the Franks must have been very severe at that time, since the same officers were invested with a military and civil power, nay, even with a fiscal authority over the subjects, which in the preceding books I have observed to be distinguishing marks of despotism. But we must not believe that the counts pronounced judgment by themselves and administered justice in the same manner as the pashas in Turkey. In order to judge affairs, they assembled a kind of assizes where the principal men appeared.
Yes, in order to kind of parliament in the French, or if you want to, even in the English sense. And a little bit later, the second paragraph before the end of this chapter.
But whoever had the jurisdiction, the king, the count, the graffio, the centenarius, the lords, or the clergy, they never tried causes alone. And this usage, which derived its origin from the forests of Germany, was still continued even after the fiefs had assumed a new form.
Yes. I mean, we are familiar with this general thought from this famous chapter on the English Constitution. In the next chapter 19, let us read the fourth paragraph.
The law of the Frisians is the only one I find that has left the people in that situation in which every family at variance was in some measure in the state of nature.
Not in some measure, so to speak. So to speak, because strictly speaking, it couldn't be in the state of nature. Why not?
There was a law of the Frisians.
Yes, that's very good. Yeah. But one can even say whether the family was in the situation. Yes, go on.
Was, so to speak, in the state of nature, and in which, being unrestrained either by a political or civil law, they might give freedom to their revenge till they had obtained satisfaction.
Now, you see, at the end of the following paragraph, he speaks of the state of nature without qualification. But it is, of course, we must understand this all the time now. After he had used the qualification once, he doesn't have to repeat it. But we must never forget this qualification thing. Yes, you see, a little bit later, two paragraphs later, the brief paragraph. By the establishment of these
laws, the German nations quitted that state of nature in which they seemed to have lived in Tacitus' time.
Yes, now that is, I think, clear that we must keep this in mind. At the end, the third paragraph from the end of this chapter.
It would have been absolutely unjust to grant a composition to the relatives of a robber killed in the act, or to the relatives of a woman who had been repudiated for the crime of adultery. The law of the Bavarians allowed no compositions in the like cases, but punished the relatives who sought revenge.
Go on.
It is no rare thing to meet with compositions for involuntary actions in the codes of the laws of the barbarians. The law of the Lombards is generally very prudent. It ordained that in those cases the compositions should be according to the person's generosity, and that the relatives should no longer be permitted to pursue their revenge.
I notice only the matter, of course, in which he speaks of what would have been unjust, and that the law of the Lombards is perhaps always, is almost always reasonable. So see, for Montesquieu, there is no possible study of laws and institutions without going into the question of the reasonableness. That goes without saying. And Sisbrom has in no way arisen here. In the next chapter, at the end of the second paragraph, we find a remark about the peculiarity of the Germans.
Contrary to the practice of all other nations, justice was administered in order to protect the criminal against the party injured.
Yes, because of the warlike character of the Germans. Today that reads as a kind of caricature about certain phenomena in this country. By the way, this remark is also interesting, perhaps with a view to the connection between books 11 and 12. You remember, 11, the English Constitution, and 12, the penal law. Both the separation of powers and the penal law, which indeed protects the criminal, belong together for the sake of freedom. And we are perhaps reminded of that here. And there is only one more passage in this book which we put out, and I think that is at the end. Yes, at the end of the book, chapter 25, last paragraph.
Page 217. The public should not forget the obligation it owes to the Abbé Dubos for several excellent performances. It is by these works, and not by his history of the establishment of the French monarchy, we ought to judge of his merit. He committed very great mistakes because he had more in view the Comte de Boulainvilliers's work than his own subject. From all these strictures, I shall draw only one reflection. If so great a man was mistaken, how cautiously ought I to tread?
By the way, here's one of the other few cases where he calls someone a great man. And you remember, Bayle was called a great man, and some others, I do not remember now the others. Machiavelli was, huh? Yeah. Here there is one point which is interesting. In the first edition it was said, if a great man of this kind has erred, and so on, the great man seems to be Boulainvilliers rather than the Abbé Dubos. I mean, I do not know, he doesn't give any reasoning for that. Only for you as a remark of itself. Yes, now I think are there any questions you would like to raise to you to chapter 30? Mr. Bruden.
Did you indicate that you couldn't use the term family, or there wouldn't be a family in the state of nature?
In what sense? I mean, how it is in Hobbes. There is an act of generation of children, and the child belongs to the mother, and whether the generator stays with the mother for the period of her pregnancy and beyond, that is entirely, there is no obligation of any kind. That presupposes already a society or community which makes it obligatory in him to stay with her and to take care of her and the child.
Montesquieu had never spoken of a state of nature before.
Oh yes, he had mentioned, he mentioned, for example, when he spoke of that the Germans were at the time of Tacitus in the state of nature, he had mentioned in the 11th book, probably in chapter 6. But he had spoken of the state of nature also in book 1, chapter 2, if I'm not totally mistaken.
I'll check. I don't think he ever used that term. He used the term the state of war.
Well, all right. I see. Well, I don't have the first part here. Is there any other point anyone would like to write?
Yeah. He speaks of such a state where men wouldn't have any other laws than those which before the establishment of societies, such as state, but not.
Yeah, but that was meant by the state of nature, but it is indeed interesting that it doesn't use the term, if you are correct. Now, first, regarding the chapter on Charlemagne, chapter 18, I believe that must be, there is another chapter on an individual in the book. Does any one of you remember it? Book 10, chapter 14, Alexander the Great, also a conqueror. And in order to form a proper judgment on 31, chapter 18, one would have to consider the judgment on Alexander. I believe that Alexander the Great appears to belong to a higher level from Montesquieu's point of view than Charlemagne.
But as a monarch?
As a monarch. Alexander was really a monarch. And he also, just as Charles, defeated the Saxons and established this Franco-German, ruled not only Frankistan properly, I mean the Frankish land, but also Germany. And therefore the original way comparable to the terrific thing which Alexander made, Greeks and Persians under the same rule. There is one point which I mentioned already before, where he makes an allusion to Charlemagne's inchastity. And let us read at the beginning of chapter 20, the second paragraph. Let us read the first two paragraphs.
When Augustus Caesar was in Egypt, he ordered Alexander's tomb to be opened. And
that reminds us of Alexander, incidentally, yes.
And upon their asking him whether he was willing they should open the tombs of the Ptolemies, he made answer that he wanted to see the king and not the dead.
The Ptolemies, were the Egyptian kings, the successors, yes.
Thus, in the history of the second race, we are continually looking for Pepin and Charlemagne. We want to see the kings and not the dead.
Yes.
A prince who was the sport of his passions and a dupe even to his virtues. A prince who never understood rightly either his own strength or his weakness. A prince who was incapable of making himself either feared or beloved. A prince, in fine, who with few vices in his heart had all manner of defects in his understanding, took the reins of the empire into his hands, which had been held by Charlemagne.
So in other words, he had few vices in their hearts. And one can perhaps say that he had many virtues of the heart. No? But he had surely great defects of the mind, and that was decisive. And this is an old question, and has been discussed by the master of those who know in the politics. In this interesting context, where he raises the question, what are the qualities required of a ruler? Which is more important, intelligence or, let us say, decency? And Aristotle, in his great wisdom, says, that depends. If it is a general, you want to have a very competent general. And if he has some vices, private vices, that is less important. But if it is a matter of the treasury, which at that time was not comparable to what a treasury means today, then the most important is honesty, an honesty which many people have, but he doesn't have to be particularly clever. On the contrary, that would go on. That is, yes. Now there is, so this question is old, and of course always known, and it is not, but the moral qualities nevertheless, from time to time one sees it, are important, although it is easy to poke fun at them. Now, let us read the end of the book, which we must under no circumstance forget. Only the last paragraph.
Page 267. I finish my treatise of fiefs at a period where most authors commence theirs.
At a point where most authors have begun it. That is the claim. In other words, what can you interpret that? What does this mean? Well, the feudists, the feudists, the professors of feudal law, presented the feudal law as it was valid at the time, i.e., or in its final finished form. Montesquieu goes back to the origins. That is, and he stops relatively early in its development, because he's chiefly interested in the origins. What does this mean? Now, this editor of the French edition makes this point. Montesquieu wished to say that instead of exposing the law of fiefs in all its details, as it was practiced at the end of the Ancien Régime, as did the authors of the treatise on feudal law, he has preferred to seek the spirit of the feudal law in its historical origins. The use of history in order to enlighten and make clear the law in its vigor was very much in his method, and that was an innovation in the 18th century. And then he quotes a passage from Montesquieu's manuscripts. I would have many things to say, but I would fear that this would not become a matter, would become a matter of pure or mere erudition. Now that is a key point. There have been people who wrote about these matters, but these were mere antiquarians. The great change which was effected by Montesquieu and his many followers in the 19th century is that this is no longer antiquarianism. I mean, it may be as bad as mere antiquarianism. That's not a question which I will go. But it is something in itself radically different from antiquarianism, because antiquarianism has only, has chiefly the motive of love of one's or one's people's antiquity, which is a very laudable motive, but which is not the highest motive which a man can have in study. He says, I would like to speak not to the memory of my readers, as the antiquarian would, but to their bon sens, to their common sense. And one is through quickly when one speaks to the addresses of common sense rather than the memory. I would rather teach them to consider the laws in their origin as to consider the laws in the origin rather than to make a book on the origin of the laws. In other words, an exhaustive, definitive treatment is not his intention, but to invite them to a new way of looking at laws, understanding them in their genesis. To the point which was raised before, I believe by Mr. Rankin, regarding where I brought up the old point, the good is the old, as a motive. Now, we must, of course, distinguish that from the historical approach of the 19th, 20th century. And the simplest way of doing that is this. If you take the equation of the good and old seriously, then you are opposed to all change. I mean, you may have grudgingly to admit it. But if you can help it, no change. Whereas for the historians, historically minded people of the 19th, 20th century, it went without saying that changes have to be accepted. And in this sense, the good cannot be the old. That would be the simplest way of stating the difference in a formal manner. So, now, let us then, you will read your type, the type part of your paper. Next time, because I think I am perfectly entitled to impose this on you, because if I had looked at the watch, or will have looked at the watch, you would have taken more than the 20 minutes to which you are entitled. so you can't complain. You will read your paper at the beginning of the next class, and then Mr. Merriweather will read his paper on the first, how many letters?
22.
22 letters of the Persian edition.